Hi, I'm Susan Wise Bauer, co-author of The Well-Trained Mind.
And I'm Susanna Jarrett, editor at The Well-Trained Mind Press. And we're talking about education for all parents and for all children in all sorts of settings. And today, I'm really excited because we're talking about teaching history.
Yay! So yeah, this season we are really sort of focusing in on nuts and bolts, particular subjects, how to approach them. And oh my goodness, history. Well, teaching history has always been a challenge, but it's become just such a battleground now.
Absolutely. And that reminds me that the last time we were at a conference selling, a homeschool conference selling our curricula, we had the story of the world out and a mother came up to the table and she asked a really interesting question. She asked, looking at our history curricula, is this the real history or is this the new history?
Ooh, what a loaded question.
Right. And it's an interesting question because I knew what she was getting at. I think there's this feeling, this sense amongst parents that, you know, back when I was a kid, we just learned what happened in the past. But now history is political and controversial. And whether she was maybe conservative, worried about a woke history, or she was liberal, worried about a whitewash history, there's this sense that why can't we just teach the facts of what happened like we used to?
Ah, back in the good old days.
Right. Exactly.
My husband and I, you know, all our kids are older now. They're in their 20s and early 30s. And every once in a while, my husband, who's just a little bit older than I am, goes into a bit of a, well, when I was a young person, nobody did these sorts of things. And I always say, sweetie, your parents thought you were going to the dogs also, you know, that you lived in a world where you were going to be constantly, you know, just we do have this tendency to valorize the past, to forget chunks of it. Mm-hmm. But I think particularly with history, so much of the history that maybe we learned, and I'll mm-hmm. say I learned because I'm older than you, Susanna, mm-hmm. when I was young, I just didn't notice the argument in it. I didn't right. notice the story. I didn't notice the fact that there was, in fact, a very particular point of view being conveyed. I mean, my goodness, I went to a conservative evangelical homeschool co-op and we read The Power and the Glory, which mm-hmm. if you're not familiar with it, is an American history that basically says America is the new Israel and is specially privileged by God among all nations and is a, you know, shining city on a hill and is run by Christian principles. And I think any serious historian would have a quibble with that, but I never even noticed, you know, the argument. I just read the book.
Right. And I think the argument may not have been quite as obvious because in many ways, our interpretation of our national story or historic memory was a little bit more agreed upon back then. Whereas now I feel like in the last 5, maybe 10 years, there's a renegotiation of what does it mean to be an American? What's American history? What are we including in that story? And so history has always been a story, always been an argument based on facts. But right now we're kind of trying to renegotiate that as a country. And so it feels really, really tense and polarizing.
Well, and I'm not even sure that there was a greater agreement about the story. I just think that if you were a person who wasn't included in that story, so, you know, go back to The Power and the Glory, doesn't talk about Native Americans, doesn't talk about the Black experience, doesn't talk about the white Catholic experience, because it's a very, mm-hmm. very Protestant book. Mm-hmm. But none of those voices were invited into the conversation to say, mm-hmm. hey, this is not our story. So it can't be the American story. So I think maybe the difference now is not so much that now we have disagreement, mm-hmm. but more people from different traditions and with different experiences have a voice. And this can only be a good thing.
Right, right. So we're in a really exciting period for teaching history, right?
I think so. It's an exciting period, and I'm going to come back to this, I'm sure, as we talk about it. But it can also be a frightening period, particularly for parents and particularly if your kids are younger, because you have this uneasy sense that maybe they're not learning the truth. And so I think that, you know, the number one task for a parent who's choosing a history curriculum or is teaching through a history curriculum is to be really self-aware. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have that sense of, oh, I'm not sure if this is right, I'm not sure if this is true, stop and ask yourself, what proof do I have? What sources could I go to?
Right.
What story is being told? And why does that story strike me as dangerous or wrong. What story was I taught instead? Mm-hmm. So if we can sort of, as parents, sort of key into that sense of unease and listen to it and try to excavate it, just, you know, as a personal thing, you don't have to share this with your kid, just as a personal exercise, then, you know, you might begin to get a little bit of a different view on history. I'm going to give you a really weird example.
All right.
Actually, it's an example that's probably going to make a lot of people mad.
Okay. I'm so, ready.
Yes.
Bracing myself.
Yeah. So there's a lot of talk about how drag queens are this sort of, you know, new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. They're being pushed on children, and their presence is pushing a certain kind of sexuality on children. And if they read a book to a child, then they're sexualizing that child. So this comes from, I think, a lot of parents, particularly, you know, probably middle class parents who never saw a drag queen or never saw a man dressed up in women's clothing pretending to be a woman. The thing is that drag performers have been part of European culture and American culture for a very, very, very long time.
Right.
You know, in British Christmas pantomimes, there's always a pantomime dame who is always a man dressed in drag. And this is like a central part of a British, you know, a British pantomime. You know, boys were dressing up as women in the sort of, you know, secret Yale social clubs since at least the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And men have dressed up as women and performed as women since the ancient Greeks, you know?
Right.
Now, because of the internet, a lot of drag performances are getting a much wider exposure. So that is definitely a difference. But the fact that men dress up as women and perform has been part of human history for as long as we know.
Right. And I think what that's a good example of is that history, and I didn't even really encounter this until I was in an undergraduate history program. So this isn't something that maybe I just missed it, but I don't think so. I think this is something that's not necessarily taught before the college level of history, but history is not just the past, the dates and the dead people, as one of my professors always called it.
Right.
It is this argument, and it is inevitably a story or an interpretation or an argument because so much happened in the past. You cannot just regurgitate that onto the next generation. You have to decide what's important to tell, right? So in the past, it just wasn't included in our national story. Nobody talked about the history of drag queens. Now, some people are saying that's important. We need to include that. We need to tell that story. And so what's changing is not what happened in the past. What's changing is what we are, how we're arranging facts and building a story and choosing what to include in that story.
Absolutely. And I should add, by the way, that my example there was not meant as an endorsement of Drag Queen Story Hour. It was simply an observation about a historical reality. I have no opinion on Drag Queen Story Hour because I've never been to one. So I would, before making up my mind about this, I would like to, you know, actually see what goes on. But we don't actually have those in Charles City, so far as I know. So that's probably not going to happen anytime soon. Anyway, back to your point, Susanna. history is a story. And if you think about this, I think a lot of times, so what that parent asked you, is this real history or is this new history? Sometimes that's phrased as, is this history accurate or does it have an axe to grind?
Right.
So I want to pick up that word accurate, because accuracy, when we're talking about history, actually has a pretty narrow application. A history is inaccurate if it gets its dates wrong, if it gets its places wrong, if it attributes quotes to the wrong people, if it takes these, you know, these incontrovertible facts about what happened in the past and gets them wrong.
Right.
That's inaccuracy. But two historians can take the same set of dates, the same set of people, the same set of quotes, and tell two diametrically opposed stories about them. And so, as an example, if you're curious, I don't actually think this is necessarily a great history, particularly for middle grade students, which is what it's aimed towards. But go read a chapter or two out of Howard Zinn's History of the United States, and you will see how he takes the same dates, the same people, the same events, the same quotes, and puts a spin on them, which is Marxist, because that's what he does. He's a Marxist historian. But all of its focus is on the balance of power between the working class and the aristocracy, and the conflict that occurs when the working class tries to seize the means of production. It's classic Marxism. Right. Nothing in that history is inaccurate. Nothing in there is, you know, I would also say it's not real. You can disagree with the story that he's telling, but you have to understand that you can't take the word inaccurate or wrong and place it over that history. You can say, I don't think that the facts support the story that you're telling.
Right.
But there's a bit of nuance there.
Right. And for a sort of advanced logic stage or rhetoric stage student, there might that's an interesting sort of exercise to look at of what is the interpretation of this history. And we'll get into, you know, where students can do this and where it's appropriate and whatnot. But I think that example is really important just to remember, because I remember when I first heard the term interpretation of history, it made me really nervous, because that doesn't mean that you can just make up a story to suit your government, to suit your kingship, whatever it is you're creating a history to promote or legitimize. You can't just make stuff up. The facts do really matter, but there's a lot of facts out there, and you can arrange them in different ways, and it can all be accurate, but it can tell different stories. So just to remember, yes, of course the facts matter. We're not saying that history is some interpretation where it's just this sort of
free for all.
Right, exactly. The facts have to matter. But you can still come away with two different stories, just like two different people can be at the same pool party or the same lunch fight and come away with two different interpretations of why it happened.
Oh, my goodness. Just ask your parents to tell you what they think happened during some big event in your teenage years. And see if it sounds at all the way that you remember the event in your teenage years. And I guarantee you that it won't. And, you know, I think this is kind of the first thing to tackle when we talk about why should you teach history in the internet age? I mean, I know that, Susanna, you have a book that you really like on this topic.
Yes, I do. There's a book that I really enjoyed by Sam Weinberg from Stanford called Why Learn History When It's Already on Your Phone. And it gets into all of this about why it's so important, particularly now with students having access to the internet, for kids to be exposed to these ideas so that they can start interpreting. There's so much information coming at them all the time. So it is more important now than ever that a middle schooler can start to build these skills to evaluate information, to look at stories, to look at interpretations, and determine what is credible, because there's just so much coming at them.
There is. And also, I like that he says on your phone, because you know what we typically do use our phones for is to just verify information, right? This is why I gather, I've actually never been to one, but pub trivia nights are now really, really complicated because everybody's hiding their phone and looking up the answers. So sure, on your phone, you can go look up any historical fact that you might not know, but you're not going to get a story.
Right.
And the story is what makes sense of the dates. Look, if we're just taught a list of facts, that's not just boring. And it is boring.
It is boring.
And it's a thing that makes people hate history. But it's also just not useful because the whole purpose of history is to tell us who we are now.
Yes.
And if we don't have a story about how we got to the present, then there is no enlightenment. There's no self-knowledge. There's no true learning that happens there. So, you know, every historian picks and chooses what facts to put in, which ones to leave out, how to arrange them in order to interpret human affairs, not just list the things that happened. That you could get on your phone, but that's not history.
Exactly. And to go back to Howard Zinn, it's knowing how to evaluate those stories and knowing how to interpret those stories, where you can push back and say, I don't think this interpretation is adding up to me. It doesn't seem like the strongest way of interpreting these facts. Or vice versa. Actually, this interpretation does make sense to explain something about how we became who we became as a nation.
And once again, I would encourage all of our listeners to, unless you find actual errors of fact, mistakes in fact, to try not to use the words wrong and right when you're talking about history. You have to be a little bit more knowledgeable to explain why you don't agree with an interpretation, but that should be our goal.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy just to say that history's wrong or even, as I've often heard, bad.
Mm-hmm.
Notice the bringing in of a ethical standard there.
Right.
For a story about the past.
But bad history would be similar to bad science or bad psychology, where they're adding data points to make the findings statistically significant. If you're literally adding facts because you have an axe to grind, like you were saying earlier, and you're just trying to tell the story no matter what the truth is, that's bad history. But that's not most of what we're talking about when we're looking at these controversial different interpretations of the past.
So I have a whole workshop called What is History and Why We Should Teach It, where I go through some different historical approaches, by which I mean different principles that historians use in order to choose and arrange their facts into a story. So I just want to do just a brief sort of run through of those. If you want to know more about these, we will link the workshop from our show notes. And I'd also really encourage anyone who's high school age or older to buy, because it's actually really cheap in paperback or as a digital book, a book called Telling the Truth About History. So this was written by Joyce Appleby, Lynn Hunt, and Margaret Jacob. And it is the clearest, most illuminating sort of survey of different historical approaches, what different historians are looking for, why they might choose to include some facts and eliminate others. It's very readable. Most of us who did graduate degrees that involved history read it in our first historiography class. It's the introduction to historiography. And it's just really a super useful book and will probably cure you forever of using the words true and false when you're talking about historical narratives.
I will link that in the show notes.
So there's sort of, I'm just going to give you four sort of large categories for historical approaches. And the first one is actually the most ancient one. It's the one that I would call biographical history. So you're telling history as the story of the lives of mostly men in ancient times, but also women as we get closer to modern times, great men and women, sort of a great men and woman approach. This is the oldest form of history that we know. So the Plutarch's Lives of the Noble Greek and Romans are probably the first example that we have of it. And telling history through the lives of people really makes the storytelling part of it easy,
right?
Because you've got a character.
Mm-hmm.
You've got somebody to follow. And so you're going to see it often with curricula for younger students because it's very concrete. It's something that they can sort of grab onto. And children enjoy stories. They're not necessarily ready to engage with younger children to engage with historical interpretation or historical arguments. So, you know, the difference here would be telling about Rome through the biographies of the famous Romans and how they lived versus saying, why did Rome fall? What were the factors? Right. Story of the World, which is our history curriculum at Well-Trained Mind, is very definitely a biographical approach. Not entirely. I mean, we do also do histories of countries and we do a little bit of why in there, but it is mostly a biographical history. It's a great men and women approach because that's just so appealing to younger readers and just so easy for them to grab onto.
Yeah. And in the Well-Trained Mind, there's also a list of great men and women per time period. Mm-hmm. I believe it's in the grammar stage chapters for history. That's a really fun list too. As a kid doing history, reading biographies, just living books, people who really were excited about a particular, about Cleopatra or Alexander the Great and wrote a picture book or a chapter book about them is such a fun way to enter into history as a young child.
Absolutely agreed. So I said that biographical history is the most ancient form. It really does come from Greek and Roman times. But the next sort of development in historical writing came during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. And it was really a development sort of spearheaded by the Christian sense of history as something that unfolds in a linear fashion. So the example that I like to use is that when the Greeks and Romans did history and they did, you know, all of these lives of different famous men of the past, they thought of history as sort of like a whole bunch of a chain, but all the links are piled together. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, they're all in just, you know, there's no particular order. All of them are important, but they don't, one doesn't necessarily lead to the next. Mm. In the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, Christian historiography sort of took that pile of links and pulled it into a straight line with a beginning and a middle and an end. And the beginning was creation and the end was the new heavens and the new earth. And the middle was everything that happened in between. But history in this, and we call this progressive history because it progresses forward, not because it's, you know, like left wing leaning, progressive, as in we're progressing forward, tends to see, first of all, the beginning as less developed than the middle or the end, because we're moving from a less perfect state to a more perfect state. So obviously there has to be movement along the way. But also, progressive history tells a particularly powerful story. And I feel like you have to be very careful if you are using a history curriculum that is progressive, because the story with the beginning, the middle, and the end is, I think, one of the most powerful ways to grab the imagination.
Yeah.
It seems so natural to us because we are natural storytellers that history would have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So The Light and the Glory, which I mentioned earlier, is a type of progressive history. So I see there sort of being three types of progressive history, and you'll see these in curricula that are intended for homeschool parents and kids. The first kind of progressive history, which is really, really common, is providential history, meaning that your interpretive grid is that God is working out his plan in history. So what's important in history is not just that we find out what happened, but that we figure out what God was doing and why.
Right.
And this is just so, this is so common in homeschool curricula. I got an email before Thanksgiving, you know, of this whole unit study about Thanksgiving. And the whole purpose of it was to show how God had led the pilgrims to the new world. And the entire, everything that was told about the settling of America told you what God was doing in the settling of America.
Right. And I wonder if a lot of times when parents look back at their own childhoods and think, you know, I just learned what happened. If they really examined, now knowing and having heard of progressive history, because this was my personal experience, when I heard about progressive history, I was like, oh, that's how I learned it. That's what I learned, was that we were always sort of, Christian or non-Christian, depending on the curriculum I was using, humanity was always sort of on this upward track. And then there were certain things that didn't fit into that history, like learning about the Inca in the late 1400s having the type of dental surgery they could do, or the type of brain surgery they could do. And it's like, whoa, wait a second. What? But humanity was supposed to be constantly progressing and we weren't there yet. And so I think this is one of the very common ones from maybe 20, 30 years ago in America, how history was taught as this, like you said, this story that we humans love stories, and that sometimes when we learn new information, it can be extra shocking because it doesn't fit into the story that we so tightly hold on to from our childhoods.
Yeah. And, you know, when you learn those stories as a young child, boy, they really grab onto you. You know, it's very hard not to read all future history in that way. And, you know, that's actually one of the great flaws of progressive history generally, is that three types of progressive history is that you can break these down into multiple subtypes, but we'll do three major ones, is that it really encourages chronological snobbery, which is the error of thinking that things that came before you in time were less perfect.
Yeah.
So, which is why, you know, maybe you were shocked to learn about Aztec brain surgery.
It
didn't fit into that. Didn't fit into that paradigm. As you can probably tell from the way I talk about it, I have actually what I would call, I mean, I have historical objections to providential history, but I think they're really grounded in a theological objection, which is essentially, you could boil it down to, okay, wait, you're speaking for God now? You know what God was doing. Boy, that is a very tricky place.
That's a lot of confidence, I guess. Yes,
indeed. I would say a lot of misplaced confidence that, you know, and, you know, all you have to do is go back and look at sort of, you know, 18th and 19th century versions of providential history and mm-hmm. see them, you know, confidently declaring what God was doing, you know, in in situations which now we look back at and say, that is right. Can't possibly be. Whatever God was doing, it wasn't that.
Right.
So, yeah. So I have arguments with providential history on several different levels. There are two other kinds of progressive history. I would call, there's a secular version of providential history, which is that we started off in sort of a mess, mm-hmm. but we are constantly moving to better and better and better things. And mm-hmm. we are becoming consistently more enlightened and fairer and kinder and more just. This is called Whiggish history because it was essentially, it was more or less the British spearheaded it. The prime example of this is a classic British history text called Our Island Story, which is sort of the British version of The Light and the Glory. The Light and the Glory mm-hmm. says that America is God's chosen country, and Our Island Story, although is secular, but it says basically the British are the best country that has ever been or will ever be. We are the pinnacle of evolution forward.
Which some people may have some issues with.
Some people do indeed. Particularly, you know, previous subjects of the British Empire.
Right.
Might quarrel with that a little bit.
Right.
And then we have Marxist history, which is also progressive because mm-hmm. in Marxist history, mankind moves from a less ideal to a more ideal state. Now, let me just say this about Marxist history. Marxist history is actually very straightforward. The basic principle behind it is that there is a conflict between workers mm-hmm. Who produce, workers mm-hmm. who actually, you know, undergird all of society by making the things that we need, the corrupt owners of the companies who control what Marx called the means of production. In other words, the factory workers are the honest, the honest people, and the guy who owns the factory and runs it from his, you know, vacation home in Florida is the corrupt part of society. And all of history is driven forward by a conflict between those two groups. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a bit of an oversimplification, but that's really what's at the core of Marxist history. So look, there is a lot of history out there that's Marxist. What I find annoying is the way in which many people use the word Marxist to mean evil, bad. Mm-hmm. If it's Marxist, you know, Marxism is like almost like the mark of the beast in history, mm-hmm. you know.
Right.
And all the word Marxism is describing is a certain theory about what drives history forward.
Right.
Much of that theory can be, you know, if you look at it, you're like, well, yes, actually, that's true. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, look at the civil rights movement of the early 20th century, and you'll see that there's a conflict here between people who were doing the manual labor and the people who controlled them and didn't want to give them freedom so that they could continue to do the manual labor. You know, there's much in Marxist historiography that you can read and be like, oh, that's pretty much what happened. Mm-hmm. But somehow Marxist has become an insult, like calling somebody satanic, mm-hmm. which, I mean, Marx was not an admirable figure, but still, I don't quite understand that reaction.
Right. Well, I think best faith interpretation would be that there is a lot of, you know, you think about Marxism, you connect that to communism, you connect that to governments and a lot of suffering for a lot of people in the Soviet Union or in communist China. And so there is that very deep, visceral reaction to something being Marxist, whereas here it's a descriptive term describing a particular way of interpreting the past. Just like we were talking about before, you can look at the past through these different lenses. And then because you're trying to tell a particular story, certain parts of the past become more important than others to emphasize in that story. So if you're doing a Marxist history, probably looking at, you're just going to look more at the conflict between workers and aristocrats. There might be more economic history, but if you're looking at providential history, you're looking more at the rise and falls of nations and kind of those types of movements. So it's just, it's a descriptive term, but it's so loaded with the connection to communist countries and the recent history there.
Yeah, I think that's a really insightful observation, Susanna. So those are the three most common kinds of progressive history, again, by which we mean histories that see the human story as moving forward from a beginning point towards a definite end, and the end is always better than the beginning, is progressive history. So two more fairly common types of history, positivism. And positivism, you're going to see this, you're not going to see this so much in curricula directed at elementary and middle school students, but you do see it more in histories for high school students. Positivism is an outgrowth of the scientific revolution, which had two really primary priorities. One was to find a physical, earthly, rational explanation for everything that happens. And the second was to look for laws that govern everything, right? So in the scientific revolution, there's this huge step forward in that gravity, for example, was conceptualized to be not just a thing that governs certain objects in certain places, but a force which works the same way everywhere, all across the universe. So this search for historic laws that laws that apply across the entire universe becomes in history, and it's during the 18th and 19th century, actually, the scientific revolution has really sort of brought about the Enlightenment and a new way of thinking. It's in those centuries that we see I won't get too far down this rabbit trail, but we see the professionalization of history. Mm-hmm. In order to be a historian, you have to go to a university, you have to be trained, you have to be trained in how to do it, you have to be trained in what proper sources are, you have to write a dissertation and have a jury of your peers pass it. The whole purpose of this professionalization was to make sure that people who did history understood the universal laws. Mm-hmm. So someone who has gone through professional historical training, in some sense, we're all positivists because we're taught to look for the big pictures, the laws that govern everybody, everywhere. Mm. And as part of that, positivists pay a lot of attention to physical factors such as the availability of food and water, climate, the availability of precious minerals, where there was salt, because all across the world, people respond to food, drink, gold, salt, water in the same way. So you can draw big conclusions that apply to all nations. Whereas to go back to our sort of biographical approach, if you are trying to explain what happened in history by saying, well, Alexander was a very ambitious man, you're dealing with something that, first of all, only applies to Alexander.
Right.
It can't be made into a law that explains anything else. And second, you're dealing with an intangible. You're dealing with a character quality.
Right.
So positive history really focuses in on tangibles and on factors that can be, you know, chalked up to these sort of universal laws. And if you read Gun, Germs, and Steel, which is a perennial bestseller by Jared Diamond, that's what he's doing. That is the classic positivist history.
That's interesting. It reminds me, I had a professor, one of my favorite professors in college, whose area of focus was sort of the spread of the Russian Empire across, and how this contiguous empire, meaning it wasn't different islands and places around the world, it was one continual piece of land that they just kept growing and growing, how that spread, comparing that to the spread of the United States westward and all of the wars with Native Americans across the plains. And there's so many parallels that he looked at, kind of the principles behind how a large empire spreads contiguously. And that, to me, sounds like what you're describing with positive history is what is a rule that applies in multiple places and time periods?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Where you see this a lot in American history is comparing America to Rome and saying, well, here are the factors that brought down Rome.
Right.
Can we see if those factors apply to America? And of course, the problem there is that we're talking about vastly different worlds.
Right.
But that impulse to look for a universal law, because it's scientific, is what we think of as positivist. So then here's going to be my last sort of like major grouping. I would call this social history. Mm-hmm. And social history, in a way, is an outshoot of Marxist history, because one of the focuses of Marxist history, which I think is actually a really good corrective, was not just looking at the movers and shakers, mm-hmm. right? So biographical history pays huge amounts of attention to what the leaders were doing, the leaders, right. the kings, the queens, and the generals. And the Marxist historian would say, hello, how about everybody else? You know, what right. were they doing down there? And tries to give equal or more weight to what the bulk of humanity were doing.
Right.
So social history is an outshoot of Marxist history in that it focuses in on the powerless, mm-hmm. the workers, the people in the factories, you know, the people who maybe couldn't read and write, and so they didn't leave their stories behind. Maybe the people who they weren't kings or generals, so nobody wrote their story for them. Mm-hmm. Telling those stories. Mm-hmm. So it is definitely an outshoot of Marxist history. But at the same time, it is also a reaction against positivism, because it's the opposite. We're not trying to tell a universal story that applies to everybody everywhere. We're trying to pay attention to individual lives and give them the weight and importance in history that they deserve. So on more of sort of like a high school or college level, there's this book called A Midwife's Tale, which is about midwifery in mm-hmm. New England. And it is so focused in on the life of this one particular midwife mm-hmm. that even though we get lots of really fascinating details, the author, it's like almost like she's scared to say, and here's what this means about midwifery in New England, or right. here's what this meant about women during the 17th century. There's just immense reluctance to draw bigger conclusions because mm-hmm. of the focus on this one life. And actually, this is one of my favorite series of books. If you're talking about elementary students, there's this whole series of books called You Wouldn't Want to Be. Mm-hmm. Like, you wouldn't want to be a Roman gladiator. You wouldn't want to be a Greek slave.
Those are fun.
Oh, they are fun.
They have nice little illustrations.
You wouldn't want to be sick in the 16th century.
Oof.
I like
no,
that one.
No, you wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't want to be a pyramid builder. You uh-huh. wouldn't want to be in the trenches in World War I. I mean, this is all chronicling, uh-huh. you know, untold stories.
Yeah.
So that is social history.
And I think social history is another really great place to see the distinction between history is not changing. We're not changing what happened in the past. But if a more traditional history from, you know, what we think of the story of kings and queens and generals, biographical history, or the story of the rise and fall of nations, now with social history becoming more and more popular, we're looking at new sources. Mm-hmm. We're looking at sources we didn't look at before. So maybe mm-hmm. we didn't look at, maybe let's say you're studying a political upheaval in the 18th century, and before you were looking at speeches and documents that were more political, but now you're doing a feminist history, which is a type of social history. So you look at the letters from the wives of the figures who were involved, and all of a sudden you have all this new information that broadens our understanding of what was happening, because you're getting the social and the female perspective on what was going on. So it's not changing what happened in the past. It's kind of adding to our understanding.
So well put. Yeah.
We'll be back after this.
If history is boring for your children, you're doing it wrong. History isn't boring. It's not a club to bash your political enemies with, and it's not a pointless list of names and dates. It's a story with pirates and Vikings and princesses, and it's all true. Susan Wise Bauer's World History series, The Story of the World, has turned over a million kids into history nerds. Her engaging narrative will make your children ask for just one more chapter. The Story of the World is available at welltrainedmind.com or wherever you buy books or audiobooks.
So I guess then the next big question is,
how do we do this?
Right.
How do we do this? How do we teach this? It feels overwhelming, because, you know, a very young child probably doesn't want to compare Howard Zinn to a traditional history and analyze the differences, right? But how do we teach history appropriately at every stage? So I think we're going to go through stage by stage through the classical progression, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and talk about how to appropriately introduce history to students in ways that are engaging and fun, but also not going to be inaccurate or putting what's the word, restrictive ideas in their heads.
Sure. And I think the thing to keep in mind here, and I don't mean to make anyone uncomfortable, is that there, again, apart from actual facts and factual errors, there's not really a wrong way to do this. Mm-hmm. It's actually a really good thing for kids to read about an event from two different perspectives, mm-hmm, or two different angles. So this becomes truer as they get older. So yes, probably, you know, where you want to be probably the most careful is in the grammar stage.
Yes. Grammar stage kids are still black and white thinkers. And if you imagine trying to tell your 6 or 7 year old, like, well, this author's interpretation of the American Revolution is interesting and it might be true, but here's another way of looking at the American Revolution. Like, not only is that going to be difficult for them to understand, it's going to be frustrating and maybe even alarming or scary for them because they're still trying to figure out how the world works. They just want to know what happened. And this kind of analytical, they're not ready for interpreting it yet. It can be very, what's the right word?
Well, it's going to blow their little minds.
Right. Right.
We'll say that. So it's my recommendation, mm-hmm, that for the younger grades, you really try to stick with biographical history, mm-hmm, as much as possible, because it first of all, this avoids the ambiguity of some other types of history, mm-hmm, right? You're talking about people, you're describing the life of a person. You can fill the kids' minds with stories about the past. There are a couple of cautions for this. One is that if you do biographical history, you really need to look out for history books that tell you why somebody did something. Mm-hmm. Keep your eye open for that. That's not true biographical history, because unless Elizabeth I wrote a letter saying, I have decided not to marry because if I get married, my husband will have all the power,
right,
then we don't really know why she chose never to marry. And the same, right, is true of every historical figure. So just keep an eye out for it. Keep an eye out for biographies that tell you more than it is possible to know about, mm-hmm, a historical figure. And as an additional caution, I would say biographical history almost always focuses on movers and shakers. Mm-hmm. So this is a great time to supplement with some of those You Wouldn't Want to Be, mm-hmm, or some other series that really give you a bit of a biographical take on the lives of people who aren't well known.
Yeah, the story of ordinary people in that country or in that culture. That's a great point. And biography is also an engaging way to teach history at that age. Biographies are inspiring in many cases. Sometimes they're sad, sometimes they're happy, but they're stories, and kids love stories.
Kids love stories. Now, there is a kind of story that I think you should steer away from for, mm-hmm, grammar stage kids, and that is progressive history. Mm-hmm. Progressive history that tells you why things happened. Right. And the reason I say steer away from that is not because progressive history as such is bad, although I've already given you my caveats about providential history, but because stories are just so powerful, and the younger, mm-hmm, the child is and the more immature their mind is, the more that story sticks with them and has the power to become the only interpretive framework that really makes sense to them.
That makes sense. And I feel like at this stage, we're trying to fill them with the raw materials of history, the dates and dead people and the facts, as much as we can in an engaging way without putting excessive interpretation. And to some extent at this age, we are interpreting history for them, right? Because, yes, it's impossible to tell the story of history without some interpretation. But as much as we can just give them these stories of what people did without the why, then they'll be ready later. They'll know the dates, they'll know the facts, and they'll be prepared for their own analysis without having, like you said, these really, really strong narratives stuck in their minds that kind of limit their ability to think creatively and analytically as they get older.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So again, story of the world, mm-hmm, but then there are a lot of good biographical curricula out there. I would say that there's another challenge, mm-hmm, with this age group, and that is you are inevitably going to find yourself reading biographies of someone who was a slave. Mm-hmm. Or ended up in a concentration camp, mm-hmm, during the Holocaust, or in a Japanese internment camp, in World War II. So there are some really difficult topics, even for young children. Yeah. So number one, I would say, don't be afraid to acknowledge that these things happened. Mm-hmm. But of course, at this age, kids really vary widely in their ability to absorb them. The more empathetic a child is, the more difficult it is for them to hear these difficult topics. So my number one rule for this would be, if you're going to talk about, you know, the Holocaust, World War II, if you're going to talk about, you know, slavery, try to avoid, see if this makes sense, Susanna. Mm-hmm. Try to avoid biographies or sources that describe a child's experience. Because children, particularly sensitive children, can empathize so clearly with another child. And so they have this very emotional investment in, oh, this little girl was just my age.
Yeah.
And here's what happened to her. This little boy, instead of doing what I'm doing, he's running outside and playing with the dog. He's in this internment camp. Right. So yes, read about what happened, but I would avoid the sort of books that give you a child's perspective on them for this age group.
That's interesting. Yeah. I think, like you already mentioned, I think this is where homeschoolers have a bit of an advantage, because children vary so wildly in what they can take, that you as the parent kind of know and can gauge what's too much while still giving them the broad overview. And I think starting with that broad overview, not personalizing it by giving a child's perspective, is a good way to dip your toe in and see where your child is. There are also a lot of book lists with age-appropriate, historically accurate books about the past. And I'll link some of them in the show notes. But I think another way to engage students with really difficult topics is through looking at these book lists and finding stories and maybe pre-reading them, especially for topics like, you know, slavery or the Holocaust. But finding books that feel appropriate for your child. And there's a lot of resources for that.
And Susanna, I feel like you also had a couple of examples of...
Yes, a few caveats with the book lists, in that I would say you do want to avoid books that are overly simplifying it to the point of making things inaccurate or almost rosy. There was a hashtag on Twitter a while ago, hashtag slavery with a smile. And it was calling out books like there's a book called A Birthday Cake for George Washington, which was a picture book where a woman and I think her daughter were taking pride and baking a cake for the president on his birthday. And it basically barely mentions the fact that they were enslaved by George Washington. And so creating this kind of rosy picture of, oh, we just love to wake up and make a birthday cake for the president, and not really showing the true story of slavery. I feel like books like that do more harm than good. So just doing a little bit of research. Again, I'll link some book lists in the show notes. Another example, I think, of books that aren't super helpful are where they use... There was, for a while, the Holocaust was just trendy. It was just popular for books. I went to a book talk with an author, Alan Gratz, who has written a lot of successful middle grade fiction. And he said something really interesting. He said, you know, he loved writing books about baseball and sports, but every time he needed to make money, he had to write a book about World War II.
Oh, that's kind of creepy.
Yeah, it really struck me, because at the time, not so much anymore, but a few years ago, just books about World War II was just popular. And so avoiding books that just use the drama of a horrific event or part of history to tell a wildly inaccurate tale. One example I have of this, a pet peeve book of mine, is The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. Mm-hmm. It's not an accurate book. It doesn't tell a story of anything that ever would have really happened, but it kind of makes use, almost exploits, you might say, the Holocaust to create this emotional story for kids. So those are my caveats with books about hard history topics to think about.
All right. Well, let's move forward now into the logic stage. At this stage, I think you can very cautiously introduce some progressive histories, but you've got to be very deliberate about it. And you have to keep asking the student, how do they know? If they say this happened and then this happened, there was cause, there was effect. Mm-hmm. How do they know? What primary sources and secondary sources are they using? And that, I think, is one of the big things that you introduce during the logic stage, a primary and secondary source.
Right. And it's so important, because there's so much that comes with that. Being able to differentiate between this is somebody else has gathered this information, interpreted it. This is somebody's firsthand account. But even within the firsthand account, There are different perspectives. You could have the perspective, for example, of a colonial soldier versus a Tuscarora warrior in the Tuscarora War. And for kids to start to learn the difference between primary and secondary sources and how to corroborate them, how to analyze them, is not only interesting and exciting for them as they're getting into the logic stage, but it's also incredibly relevant for teaching history in the internet age. Because those skills, often called like historical thinking skills, are becoming ever more critical for every student to start to develop, because we all have access to an overwhelming amount of information on the internet. We're bombarded with it all the time. And as kids are learning how to look at the credibility of a primary or secondary source, they're learning how to use the internet effectively and not just accept whatever comes down the line on social media.
And I guess we tend to think that, I mean, and maybe this is more true of someone my age who, I mean, I still remember the huge thrill of connecting to AOL and hearing my phone line go bing and being like, oh, I'm going to connect with the great world. But, you know, because our kids have grown up with this and it seems so natural to them, maybe we tend to think that they understand what's out there better than they actually do.
Absolutely. And this is one thing that Sam Weinberg from the book I mentioned at the beginning, Why Teach History When It's Already on Your Phone, said, which I think is important to think about. We've fallen into a mythology that the ability to operate a device translates into the sophistication needed to evaluate the information the device yields.
Ooh.
So just because a kid is really good at navigating the iPad and knows how to use the iPad better than you do, doesn't necessarily mean that they've learned the skills they need to be able to evaluate the information coming at them from that iPad. Mm. In fact, there was some studies done a few years ago by Stanford that found that 80% of middle school students could not differentiate between a news article and sponsored ad content.
Oh, that is a frightening statistic.
It is frightening. And I'll give you another frightening one. There were 30% of students who looked at a fake news site and thought it was more credible than the real news site because of the graphic elements being better.
Now, I had not actually heard this, but Susanna, you gave me a great, great example. And I went and looked it up. And it's so funny and charming that I think it would be really, really easy to be fooled. And the site is, I'm sorry, I love this so much. It's Save the Pacific Northwest Tree Octopus.
Yes. And this is actually something you can give your students. I remember having a lot of fun with my middle school students. We gave them this website, which was created, I think, by a teacher. It's a completely fake website about this Pacific Northwest tree octopus that's about to go extinct and we need to help it. And there's a button where you can donate money. There's links to news articles about it. And it's about an octopus that lives in a tree.
And there's this great photo of the octopus in
there's
the
even
tree.
A picture.
There's even a picture. And this is super sneaky too. Over on the left-hand side, there's a whole series of links to articles from really, really reputable sources like Science, Nature, The Washington Post. And if you click on them, they are legitimate articles about octopi, but not a tree octopus.
Right. So if you give your students this website, they have to learn how to be really careful with analyzing a source. And one way that I would really encourage parents to help kids with that is by teaching them to conduct lateral searches on the internet, which means that a lot of kids naturally, when you ask them to evaluate a source or evaluate an internet website, they go to the about page or they try to go deeper and deeper into the website. They try to look for the author. They look for the year it was published. And some students, when asked, will think that opening a new tab or looking to see what somebody else says about that book or that source or that website is cheating. Hmm. But actually, that's absolutely not cheating. That's what we call corroboration. That's really, really important. It's the fastest way to check something. So a student could go pretty deep into this website, Save the Pacific Octopus, and not be able to know for sure if it's fake. But if they simply open a new tab and look it up, they'll find very quickly that it was created by teachers to dupe students. And so that's a lateral search. And it's just an example of how, in the context of teaching middle schoolers the difference between primary and secondary sources and these historical thinking and analysis skills like corroboration, you can fold in a lot of important internet search skills that go beyond just doing history, but actually are going to help them throughout their life as they navigate the online world.
So I feel like it's really important in this logic stage to create students who are little skeptics.
Yeah.
Right? Right. So is to always be saying, well, so first of all, when you're doing history, the first thing you always ask is, does the author or does the book or whatever it is that you're using, do they say why this happened? Mm-hmm. How do they know?
Right.
If you research this, do other people agree with them? Mm-hmm. What other explanations are there? So just teaching students to really question mm-hmm. is important. And I understand that this may feel uncomfortable to parents, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, yeah, I don't know. We have this desire to pass on our understanding of the world to our kids. Mm-hmm. Totally natural, totally normal. It just doesn't work because there are so many other interpretations of the world out there. What is really important is that we teach our kids to know why they accept a particular story, why they accept a particular interpretation. And in order to do that, you have to teach them to be skeptical.
Mm-hmm. And middle school students, you'll find that teaching them to be skeptical often comes very naturally. they'll enjoy it.
It's an age appropriate thing to do.
Exactly. Whereas a grammar stage student might be overwhelmed by the idea of, wait, you just said my book might not be all the way true all the time.
What?
What? A middle school student will be like, yeah, let's see how we can prove them wrong.
Yeah.
And so I think it is really a natural place. History is a really natural place to start doing these really fun, engaging activities with kids to help them to start thinking this way and analyzing, you know, do they have the facts they need to make that claim? Do they have the evidence for me to accept that claim?
Absolutely. And then if we move on to the rhetoric stage, I mean, in some ways, this is much simpler because mm-hmm. at this point, students have the mental maturity to use the knowledge and the knowledge they've accumulated through studying mm-hmm. actual historical texts, but also the experience in figuring out whether that is true mm-hmm. or reliable or the best interpretation, they can really begin to start doing history. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got grammar stage collection of information, mm-hmm. all the people that you learned about, and the right. logic stage skills of, you know, sort of understanding cause and effect, locating mm-hmm. the argument in a piece of history, trying to decide whether or not they agree. Mm-hmm. Really prepares them for what I would say is the prime task of rhetoric stage history, which is saying, what does this history tell us about human nature, mm-hmm. about who people are, about why people act the way they do, either individual people, if you're doing this in more of a social history way, or a whole group of people. At this point, it's completely accurate to speculate and to say, why do you think Elizabeth I never married? Mm-hmm. And what's your proof? What are you not your proof? Proof is the wrong word. What facts and sources are you basing that conclusion right. on? And it's also it's also a good time to ask the really even more complicated questions about groups of people. Mm. Why was slavery legal in the United States for so long? Mm. There was mm-hmm. a consensus here between a whole lot of people mm-hmm. that slavery should exist. Why? What drove that? Why did so many Germans go along with Hitler? Mm-hmm. You know, because yeah. we could not have had the Holocaust without the cooperation right. of a lot of people who followed Hitler. So asking those why questions about both individuals and groups of people with the tools that the student has mm-hmm. Accumulated, you know, over right. the last years of study is really the goal of high school history. And oh, Susanna, it makes me crazy mm-hmm. when people hate high school history, and they hate mm-hmm. high school history because that's not what they're doing. Mm. They're being right. taught dates and places.
Right. Which is so boring to them by that point. A young child just learning dates and places can be interesting. But to a rhetoric stage student, these questions, like you said, how did it happen? How did so many people go along with Hitler? That's a fascinating and very complicated question. It makes history so much more interesting. And also this way of doing history, it takes every part of the classical education. It makes use of all the skills, not just what they're doing in quote-unquote history class, mm-hmm. but what they're doing throughout their education, from gaining information as a grammar student to questioning sources and developing arguments in both English and history as a logic stage student, to being able to then think for themselves and think clearly and and start to express their own ideas in their rhetoric stage, history can become this really great tool for the progression of the whole classical education.
Absolutely. So how do you teach history in the internet age? Well, you don't rely on the internet.
But through what you're doing, you are preparing students to use the internet effectively.
Yes, and absolutely.
I think that's really, really important right now.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Could not agree more. So really go to our show notes, guys, because mm-hmm. we've put lots and lots of interesting resources and links in there for you.
Absolutely. I'll also link a few different websites that have ideas for free lessons and assessments for teaching these historical and analytical thinking skills and logic stage that I've used before that are a lot of fun. So I'll link those as well. There's a lot of stuff in the show notes this week. So yes, please be sure to check it out. And as always, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on classical education, home education, school education, or any kind of education that interests you. You can reach us at podcast@welltrainedmind.com. Thanks for listening.